Rachel Grimm, and welcome to the podcast With All Your Mind. I'm here to help us understand the Bible with cultural and historical context, linguistic info, and other cool stuff. Enjoy. All right, good afternoon, guys. This is Rachel, and this is With All Your Mind. Welcome back. You made it through the Hebrew section of season 3, where we got into some kind of the lesser known Hebrew things that affect the way that we read our Bible, the way that it sounds to us, even through English, even through translation. So now we're going to move on to some Greek things, some what we'll call Hellenistic things and Roman things. And we'll get into all of that and what that means. But it also means that we're moving on from the Old Testament to the New Testament. The Old Testament is written largely in Hebrew, written over the course of 1,000 years, from about 1400 BC to about 400 BC. So there was a lot of linguistic change in there. If you look at the book of Job versus the book of, say, Jeremiah or even Malachi, there's going to be a lot of linguistic changes in there. And there's a lot of words in Job that we don't even know what specifically it means, because it's older language, kind of archaic, in the same way that if you read something out of Shakespeare, or better yet, Chaucer, you'd be like, I think I know that word, but it's actually used in a way that you didn't know. So Hebrew has a lot of variation because it was written over a huge span of time. The New Testament was written in a much shorter period, only 100 years. Right after the time of Jesus, up until about 150 AD. So when we talk about Greek, we're just talking about the New Testament, unless you're talking about something like the Septuagint, which we'll get to. So just some news, I guess, is that we only have 2 more episodes after this one for the season. It's a shorter one, unless you guys want to do like a question and answer kind of episode. So if you have anything from this season that you're like, I need to know more about that, or you have a different question, or something totally random, I don't care, whatever. If you do have a question, send it in, and I'll do my best to answer it. If I don't know, I'll tell you. So that's one piece of news. The other one was, I like to tell you guys this once in a while, and that is that I record episodes a little ahead of time. Like this one that I'm recording right now, I don't think it'll be published for like 2 or 3 weeks. And I love the fact that if I died tomorrow, I would be haunting you guys on the internet for 2 weeks. So just thought I'd put that out there. Okay, so we're going to be talking today about Greek, or what we call Hellenistic or Roman influence in the New Testament. And we tend to talk a lot more about the New Testament in both the languages with Greek versus Hebrew, and with culture, the Greek and Roman world of the New Testament versus the Semitic world of the Old Testament, and also about theology in the New Testament versus the Old Testament. The New Testament just gets way more press. It gets way more attention, and there's good reasons for that and not so good reasons for that. The good reasons are that it is the culmination of the Bible, right? It is where the new covenant through Jesus is talked about, and where we understand Jesus' place in the whole covenant, and we can say the fulfillment of the law. And you don't get the end of the story, obviously, until the end of the book. And so people like to focus on the end of the story, the end of the book. And that's the New Testament. Now, the not so good sides of why we pay more attention to the New Testament is that the New Testament is just easier. It is easier to understand. The language and the culture of the New Testament are Indo-European. They're not Semitic. The Old Testament is Semitic. It's more foreign. It's more foreign sounding. The names sound more foreign. And by the way, we have episodes about all of this stuff, especially in the first season, episode 1 and either 2 or 3 of the first season. But also we have more information about the New Testament era. The Old Testament was before there were a lot of written records. It was before papyrus came about as a way to write down things, and papyrus was a way easier way of writing things down versus what was used in Old Testament times, which was mostly parchment and pottery. So those things were just a lot harder to write on and take care of to make. We have episodes about this too, by the way. To make a parchment scroll took way more resources, way more time than to write a papyrus scroll. So there's just a lot of practical reasons why we have more information about the New Testament. It feels more familiar. It sounds more familiar. We use the Greek and Roman versions of a lot of names and not the Hebrew versions of the name, of just different names in the Bible. So yeah, it's just more familiar. We have more resources. We have more history. Historians were writing whole history at the time of the New Testament. Josephus and Herodotus, I think I usually say his name wrong, Herodotus, he's considered the father of history, and he wasn't writing until the 400s BC, and there are others as well. So it's just easier to learn about the New Testament, and I like the underdog, so I go for the Old Testament. That's part of the reason why I like Hebrew. So what we're going to do today, we're going to look for evidence of Greek and Roman culture in the New Testament, right? And that doesn't sound totally groundbreaking, but we're going to do that for this episode and the next one. And that might, well, it might surprise you why that's important. But first, we need a kind of a bit of an overview of the history of Israel. Israel was its own nation, though divided, up until when Assyria conquered the northern kingdom of Israel in 720 BC. 720. So 700 years, 700 plus years before Jesus. And Babylon conquered the southern kingdom of Judah in 586 BC. So about 600 years before Jesus. And then the Greeks rolled in around the 300s BC. And the Greeks had a policy of letting their conquered peoples worship their own gods. And they kind of just expected them to adapt their gods to a bigger system of kind of like, that's fine, you worship your gods, but add them on to our gods as well. Just add them onto the list. It's all cool. So there was lots of pressure just to conform to Greek culture along with your own. Like, you don't have to abandon your own culture, but add it into the Greek culture. And the Jews of Jesus' day and before were really torn about this. Rome conquered Greece in the 100s BC, and then it was Greek and Roman culture that was influential. It wasn't like Greek culture just kind of disappeared. The Romans really liked Greek culture and adopted a lot of things from Greek culture. And the Romans, culturally, were more strict about things, but they actually did bring peace. So from about 300 BC on, there was this tension and cultural question of how to interact with the culture in power, whether to rebel or not, and how to maintain, and this is important, how to maintain cultural and spiritual purity. So when you look at the New Testament and see evidence of Greek or Roman culture, you can't just toss it aside and say, oh, well, you know, of course, that happened because Rome was in charge. Yeah, true. But there still might have been a lot of tension and prayer and deliberation and questioning and decision-making going on about how someone of the Jewish culture would have participated with that thing. That's why there's so much in Paul's letters that deals with how to handle Gentiles, which are the Greeks and anybody else, and Jews coming together. How to participate in the world where meat was offered to idols, whether circumcision should be required. It's a clash of cultures, and it's a big deal. We're going to start with a particular word and then go to some objects, and then we're going to go to a whole scene in the book of John. And I was reading the book of John. That's where I was in my quiet time. I just finished it. I'm in Acts now. And that's where I got a lot of my pictures and ideas for this podcast season was from the book of John. So we're going to start with the very first verse of the book of John. It's because it has that special word that's mentioned a lot in the first chapter of John. It's the word logos. And you might hear logos, It's Logos or Logos, it depends. I use Logos Bible software. And so that's one way you might have heard that. In modern speech and debate, Logos is a logical appeal as opposed to ethos and pathos, right? Those are the emotional and ethical appeals, kind of like trying to make you feel for something. That would be the emotional appeal. Logos is the logical appeal. And then if you've ever studied the book of John, you've probably heard Logos in that. So what is it in the Bible? So this is what John 1:1 says. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In verse 2, it says, He was with God in the beginning. So verse 1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and that's the word logos in Greek. And then in verse 2, it switches, He was with God in the beginning. If it was just Word, it would say it, right? It was with God in the beginning. And then it continues on. In verses 2 all the way up to verse 14, it says he, when it was referring to logos. And you see I'm flip-flopping back and forth between logos and logos. Whatever, it doesn't matter. But then in verse 14, it resumes with, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of one, the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. So in John 1, we're talking about logos or logos, and it starts off with talking about logos, and then it says he, and then it goes back to logos, and you know it's talking about Jesus, but what are you supposed to make about this word logos or logos, and the fact that it's word? Well, the first thing you need to know is that the beginning of John 1 is echoing Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. John is tying together a few ideas here. He's echoing Genesis 1 to indicate that what he's talking about has been around since creation. It is God. It is a person. And that person is the same as Logos. So what is Logos? And even for me, I know Greek. I've studied Greek off and on, over and over. And I've probably studied the Bible a bit more than the average bear. I don't know what the average bear is, but I'm guessing. I still didn't have a totally clear idea of what this word meant. Like, I generally knew, but what are we trying to do here by mentioning this word? So in Greek, logos means word, account, or thing. It's pretty flexible. But if a person said, I spoke a word, you would say, I spoke a logos. This still goes back to Genesis 1. God created by speaking. He didn't wave around a magic wand. He didn't stomp his foot. He spoke, and it came into existence, right? And some Jewish teachings basically portray it as a word comes out of God's mouth and becomes an object. So the act of speaking creates. They made it very tangible. But there's more than that. Logos in Greek also refers to a philosophy. And this is the part that I was very hazy about, that I kind of knew a bit about, but I didn't really understand. My NIV Archaeological Study Bible, again, I've been using this book a lot for a lot of things. It had a fantastic note about logos. I'm going to quote it here. Heraclitus, which was a guy from about 500 BC, he was a Greek philosopher, and he used logos in the sense of an ordering principle of the universe. Okay, let me repeat that. An ordering principle of the universe. So in Greek philosophy, logos is kind of like a divine logic, a divine reason, a divine mind that gives order to the universe. Stoics saw it as the force, basically, a mystical force that gave order and rationality to the world. So it's not like the force of Star Wars, where it's just a power. It's a force of reason, a force of organization and logic and rationality. Kind of like, how do we make sense of the world? Well, logos makes sense of the world. Logos orders the world. Why is there a food chain? Logos that made it that way. Why is there a rain, what is it called? Water system? Water cycle? Yeah, water cycle. Why is there a water cycle? Logos made it that way. why do planets revolve around the sun in a way that creates the perfect environment for the Earth? Logos did that. So that's what Greek philosophy would say. So a Greek speaker who understood Greek philosophy could read John 1 and think, oh snap, Logos isn't a force binding the universe. It's God. It's Jesus. So if I wanted to be connected to the unifying, logical, ordering, perfect, stabilizing, rationalizing, harmonizing thing, it's through Jesus, not through philosophy or trying to follow Greek philosophy. Greeks were looking to explain how the universe functioned and how humans have any reason at all. Like, why are we the highest being? Why do we have reason? Why can we do engineering? Greeks were trying to figure this out. So Logos is also connected to human reason. How is it that we can be connected at all? John was saying, it's all Jesus. He tied together Jewish thought, universal truths, and Greek philosophy to say, Jesus is the answer. No matter what question you have, no matter what side of the argument you're coming from, Jesus is the answer. And one word in Greek brought all of those ideas together. So if you've ever wondered why the beginning of John 1 sounds weird, it's because it's so deep. There's so many things going on in there. So speaking of a lot of things going on, this is one that Ryan told me about a long time ago, and I was skeptical. Who's heard of Aesop's Fables? I read Aesop's Fables off and on as a kid and as an adult, partly because of Russian fables and stories that I would read when I was learning Russian, but also my parents had a collection of, what is it called? Book of Virtues? I forget the whole name of it. And we would read Aesop's Fables in there, and I'm pretty sure they had some other books that had like animal stories. Aesop's Fables were like a lot of animal stories that had a moral to it. One of the ones I always remember is the ant and the grasshopper. And the ant was super busy, constantly collecting food all summer long. And the grasshopper was like, I'm just happy in the sun. And the ant was like, you better get to work because winter's coming. And the grasshopper ignored the ant. And then the grasshopper had no food over the winter. It's a good example of Aesop's Fables where it's a moral and a kind of a cutesy story that almost always involves nature. That's Aesop's Fables. And another one is The Ass in the Lion's Skin, and ass meaning donkey. And this is one where a donkey is having a good old time. He puts himself into a lion's skin that he finds somewhere, and he's having fun scaring all the other animals until he forgets himself and he accidentally brays like a donkey and gives himself away. And the moral of the story is your appearances may help you to do things, but if you're a fool, your speaking will give you away. A similar proverb is better to be thought a fool than open your mouth and remove all doubt. And this might sound pretty familiar to you. Yeah, it was used in the Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis used it in his last book as the Chronicles of Narnia. It's an Aesop's fable. So he just adapted it, right? And Aesop was a Greek writer. And we don't know exactly how many of his stories were written by him specifically, kind of attributed to Aesop, but they were written hundreds of years before Jesus' time. I think about the 500s BC. And I have a full article linked in the show notes showing that Jesus uses the same phrase that is used in two of Aesop's fables, specifically the fox and the goat in the well, and the frogs at the wedding of the sun. Now, because Aesop's fables are so old and they were used a lot of different times by a lot of different people, there's kind of a standard version that we use today, but there's many versions of these stories through history where each story has like slightly different details. Like I read the frogs at the wedding of the sun, and I read like three different versions of this story. But the frogs at the wedding of the sun are either really happy that they're celebrating the wedding of the sun until they realize an old frog gets mad at them. And he's like, what are you idiots thinking about? Why are you happy that the son is getting married? That means he's going to have little baby sons, and sons are not our friends. They dry us up. So he's telling them, you fools, what are you even thinking about? But here's the phrase that Jesus uses, okay? It's from Luke 24:25. After Jesus was raised from the dead, he's walking along the road to Emmaus with some of his disciples, and they were pretty down. They were really discouraged because this is after the crucifixion, and they're saying, we really thought this guy was going to be the Messiah. And then he died, and Jesus was like, oh, tell me the story. I haven't been in town that long. Tell me the story. They were super discouraged that Jesus was dead, but they couldn't find his body because of the resurrection. And this is what Jesus says. He said to them, how foolish you are and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. So that line, the very first line, how foolish you are and how slow to believe. It's literally in the Greek, how foolish you are and slow in heart. And that is verbatim in a few copies of those two Aesop's fables, how foolish you are and slow in heart. But copies of those versions of those fables are from the 15th century. So it's kind of like saying, you know, there's a game of telephone with these fables and people wrote them down different ways. There's versions from the 15th century that have that verbatim line in there. And we don't have anything from before that. We don't have older copies of Aesop's fables, which isn't weird. It's just how history works. They were, you know, disintegrated, kept in a damp place, and they fell apart. And there are just many versions of Aesop's fables, and that's just one of them. So it's a kind of a chicken and egg thing. Were the Aesop's fables that way, and Jesus quoted them? Or did someone rewrite an Aesop fable to use Jesus' words? I was pretty skeptical about this, even while I was reading the article. And I was about to take this example out of this podcast episode because I was like, this is kind of sketchy. I don't know. And then I read that whole article, and there's a lot of linguistic things in there. And if you care to read it, go for it. I'm going to link it in the show notes. But it's basically like, oh, it really does look like Jesus was quoting just that one little line from Aesop's fables. And I realized that if Jesus is quoting an Aesop fable to these two guys, it softens this line to me, how foolish you are and slow in heart. It's not like he's saying, you idiots. It changes the tone. He's using a story to kind of be like, come on, guys, you're being like those silly frogs. Don't you remember what the prophets said? So it really changed things for me to read that in a different tone. Okay, so I'm not going to go into all the linguistic-y reasons why I believe that it's a pretty good argument that Jesus was quoting Aesop's fables, but it looks pretty sound to me. And it's good to mention that the phrase as it appears in Luke 24 and Aesop's fables doesn't look like much of anything else in Christian literature of the first century. And it doesn't look anything at all like what we see in the Septuagint. So, last thing for this episode today. Do you want to know what started this whole idea of looking around in the New Testament for Greek and Roman influences? And really wanting to do season 3 of the podcast at all? It was the triclinium. The triclinium, or triclinia. Who knows what that is? I would really love to know. If you know what that is, you totally know what that is, let me know. And if you don't, let me know. I'm so curious. It is, and we really only care about this thing from one picture, and it is from the Last Supper. And if you look it up, you can look it up online, including through the show notes. I have a couple of links for things to show you what a triclinium was. It's a Roman couch. It's a Greek or Roman couch. And what it was is you would have these kind of tables, but they're slanted. And you'd have these slanted tables, and they could be low, they could be a little bit higher. no higher than, say, couch height, and maybe as low as ottoman height or little footstool height. And it would be basically slanted tables or a wood frame couch that would use maybe leather straps. Sometimes they would put like beams or concrete down to make these low benches that were slanted away from a center, and in the center would be a table, like a flat normal table. And people would eat from the center table, and it would be like they're kind of, that's why they say reclining at a table in the New Testament, is because they weren't lying down. They were slanted away from a center table on kind of benches or couches. Or kind of, if you remember rattan furniture from the 80s, where it would have straps and then you just throw big cushions in there, they could do that as well. So that's a general idea of what a triclinium is. And I could not get out of my brain that I was like, why would Jesus and his disciples be eating at one of these tables? It seems really fancy to me. Like, it does not seem normal to me. It doesn't seem like what you would be doing in Bethlehem. Now, I know they were doing it in Jerusalem, but this doesn't seem, by extension, very Jewish to me. Like, it just seemed a little bit off, and I could not get it out of my head. It seemed uppity, expensive, having to do with higher class, Greek or Roman higher class, not even Jewish higher class. So the word itself, triclinium, is never mentioned in the Bible. It's a Latin word, and Latin is not in the Bible. But it comes from Greek, and at first it meant a dining room. Triclinium meant dining room. And then later it meant a table with those couches around it. It's kind of a horseshoe arrangement of couches around a table, and one end wouldn't be open, not four couches around a table, because then you couldn't get to the table. You would do three so that a servant or someone could get to the table to put more dishes on or take dishes off. It was actually a Turkish invention, and by Turkish I mean Asia Minor, what we consider Asian Minor in the Bible. And the Greeks liked it and elaborated on it, and then the Romans adopted it because they liked it too. Now, it's assumed that Jesus and his disciples often ate at a triclinium, including at the Last Supper, because it says they reclined. Now, this is interesting because Jews usually sat at meals, right? Not reclined like Greeks and Romans. But Jesus and his disciples reclined. They were eating in a Greek style, at least for the Last Supper. So they ate in a Greek style, even though they were all Jewish. And by the way, some of the apostles had Greek names. That's not uncommon. But they were all Jewish, or most likely all Jewish. So let's talk about this triclinium. A central rectangular table, nothing weird there, with the couches, with their wood frames, with leather straps that held cushions, or boards that were slanted away from that table with cushions or blankets on top. A triclinium in Pompeii was concrete slabs sloped away from a central pit where a table could be put. There's a link in the show notes for that. There's a picture of that. And Pompeii was destroyed in 79 AD, so like 30, 40 years after Jesus died, so that that triclinium, that type of triclinium, could definitely have been around in Jesus' time, right? So this was kind of an upper class thing to do, a Greek upper class thing to do. The seating and arrangement could be fancy, and they definitely took up space that smaller, poorer homes just didn't even have. You needed a decent-sized room to do this. And there's a lot in the show notes about how the tables would be set up and who specifically would sit at which table to give them the best view, so that you would set up your triclinium in a room that you could have a good view out of the balcony onto the garden, blah, blah, blah. This was a fancy thing to do. It wasn't just like, hey, let's go grab a bite to eat. This was a party, okay? So we don't know how Jesus ate his everyday meals. I really doubt most people had their everyday meals at triclinium, okay? It was a dinner banquet type of thing. And often We hear about Jesus being out early in the morning to pray. Did he even eat breakfast? Was Jesus a breakfast eater? We don't know. What we do know is that sometimes, including at the Last Supper, he ate in an upper class Greek style that was associated with feasting and having guests. Why? Well, I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you. We aren't to the point of talking about Jesus yet. That's for the last episode. So you just need to start thinking about these things now. I'm giving you homework, okay? So I'm going to remind you that if you want to do a question and answer episode, we can do that, but you need to send in your questions soon because there's only two more episodes after this, and then I'm hanging up my microphone so that I can do my master's class, which starts in 2 weeks. Okay, so yeah, that's about it. I'm going to leave you hanging there, and I hope you guys have a great day, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.